get older, losing my hair many years from now. Will you still be sending me a valentine, birthday greetings, bottle of wine? If I'd been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
This is Dr. Rob Stahl bringing you the only local call-in radio program exclusively for older adults and caregivers. What should you expect at your age? The answer is a lot, and that's what we're here to explain. Today is Monday, April 4th, 2005, and welcome to today's show. I had to pre-record this show, so you won't be able to reach us live with your calls, but our station engineer, Mr. Jimmy Smith, is happy to take a message and forward it on to me. I'll either get back to you personally, get your question to someone who can help you, or comment about it on next month's show. But please do call. The phone number is 855-6848. This show and all previous shows are available for replay on the web at whatshouldyouexpect.com. All one word except for the dot. There's also links to a lot of good additional information from the website. Check it out. Last month, we discussed the past, present, and future of geriatric care with Dr. Evan Calkins and Ms. Beverly Cabala. If you missed the show, you can hear it again from the show's website, whatshouldyouexpect.com. Today, I'm very happy to have with me attorney Laurie Menzies, a senior partner with the law firm Falscraft, Beinauer & Menzies, who, by the way, are generously sponsoring today's show, and a specialist in the legal issues of older adults. We also have Dr. Ralph Benedict, head of neuropsychology at the Erie County Medical Center. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, Rob.
Hello, Bob.
The topic for today is a timely one, advanced directives and the determination of capacity to make healthcare decisions. We all know what's going on in the news, and we hope to clarify some of those issues for our audience today. Ms. Menzies, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became an elder law attorney, and also exactly what is an elder law attorney?
Yeah, actually I didn't grow up planning to be an attorney, nor specifically an elder law attorney. I have older parents, they don't mind me saying so. They're 88 and 81, and they had me when my sister and brother were approaching 20 years old, so they started their family all over again, and I grew up with people that really could have been closer to my grandparents. And so Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra, and all of the old stuff was something that I just got used to, and I have a very easy rapport with people who are in their late 80s, kind of 70s and 80s, and I know where they come from. It just now comes in handy. I didn't realize that this was where I was going to end up working, but I did go into estate planning after graduating from Vassar. I moved to Boston and was in working in the investment field and found my way to working in a trust department where most of my clients just happened to be surviving spouses of people with a lot of money that would set up a trust account for them. So my clients were older, but at that point I was more interested in doing the estate planning for them and working with their attorneys, and what I found was a lack of communication skills in most of the attorneys that I was running into, and thought, you know what, if I went back to school, I might be able to do a better job. And so that was my goal, going back, and I stayed with learning estate planning, and I was fortunate enough at UB to work at Legal Services for the Elderly, where I really got a hold on some of the issues that really affect a good estate plan. All of us grow old with a different amount of money, and then different things happen, whether it's a health issue or family situations, you know, or your money hasn't been well planned for. And so the elder law field is a new and growing field in the legal realm. And over the last 10 or 15 years, our section of the bar has really grown. And what we do is we specifically concentrate on the legal needs of people who are getting older. And all of us are, actually. We were talking about that before, that it affects every single one of us. And as part of an estate plan now, rather than just concentrating on estate taxes and money and wills, there are these things called advanced directives that we're going to talk about today, like powers of attorney and healthcare proxies, and the documents that help you to age well and have other people help you when your incapacities start. And that, unfortunately, all of us go through the need to have other people help us if we get old enough.
Well, let me stop you right there. So, you know, we don't give away the punchline to the show completely. Mm-hmm. Basically, you were a young kid that wanted to improve the world, and that's how you ended up in elder law. And I think that's wonderful. And
I'm an old kid that wants to do the thing.
No, I don't think so. Okay, Dr. Benedict, how about you? Let's start where you were born and what happened in those early years.
Well, my story begins in Columbus, Ohio, and I'm a graduate of Ohio State University, and I was I went into clinical psychology in Arizona State University, and it was there that I became very fascinated with the way brain function relates to behavior and psychological phenomena. And I also discovered at that time that there was an emerging field called clinical neuropsychology. It was a small step from that point to join the residency program at Johns Hopkins, where I was for 2 years. And then I landed in Buffalo because they had a very good opportunity here to develop neuropsychology in the neurology department at UB.
And we have a terrific neurology department. We have world-renowned research and treatment for multiple sclerosis. We have some excellent practitioners, both neurologists and neuropsychologists. Now, why don't you just define how neuropsychology differs from neurology or psychology?
Well, it differs from neurology in that I didn't go to medical school. I'm a psychology PhD. And to be a clinical psychologist, the primary responsibility in learning is to objectively measure behavioral phenomena. And so a lot of my work depends on psychological assessment. And when we put neuro in front of psychological, what we mean is that the information relates to how the brain works. You mentioned multiple sclerosis. An example there would be that it's my job to measure memory and concentration abilities in MS patients because those are frequently affected. We want to measure them so that we can see whether or not medications work, whether or not patients may need disability or be incapable of managing activities of daily living, for instance.
Now, what other diseases do you generally get involved with? I imagine stroke and I'm sure Alzheimer's disease. And what's the range?
Stroke is something I commonly work with, vascular dementia, Alzheimer's disease. There are other senile dementias that I see a lot of. Traumatic brain injury is something I commonly deal with. And a whole host of developmental or chronic psychiatric disorders. And as time goes on, we gain greater appreciation of how illnesses like bipolar disease and schizophrenia are mediated by brain dysfunction as well.
And throwing that together with new imaging techniques, with we've had CT scan for a while, now we have special CTs, special MRIs, we have things called PET scanning that can view the brain in a more functional way. That must make it very exciting for you to throw all that together, work with your neurologist colleagues, other psychologists, other people involved in your office helping to do assessments.
Very exciting indeed. We're doing a lot of work with structural brain imaging here at the Jacobs Neurological Institute. And none of that means anything, though, unless we understand what the correlate is with psychology or behavior. You can have a huge brain lesion, but if the person is normal, then what's the significance of that? And so I come in trying to figure out what the meaning of brain pathology is in terms of quality of life, cognitive abilities, psychological phenomena.
And taking that next step, what to do about it. Once you identify what's going on, then it makes it easier to devise ways to help the person.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, the Terry Schiavo case that's been in the headline news for the past few weeks has been very sad for the Schiavo family, for Terry's husband, and Terry herself. But there's good coming out of it, I do believe. And that good is that the importance of letting the rest of the world know clearly and in writing what you would want if you could not make your own health decisions has never been more succinctly stated and brought more to the fore into everyone's consciousness than ever before. The first half of today's show, I want to talk generally about what an advance directive is and why the determination whether a person can or cannot make their own health decisions is so important. The second half, we'll discuss specific forms of advance directives that are legally binding, both here in New York State and generally, and specific tests that can be done to determine capacity. Now, I want to give a brief overview of Terry Schiavo's case. She was born in December 1963 and got married to Michael Schiavo in 1984. She had an eating disorder called bulimia, which in February 1990 caused a chemistry imbalance in her blood, which resulted in cardiac arrest and severe brain damage. She was resuscitated, but has been in a comatose state for 15 years. Doctors verified that the brain injury is such that she will never again regain consciousness. In May 1998, Terry's husband, Michael, petitioned the courts that his wife would have not wanted to live in a comatose state being sustained by a feeding tube, which is what she had. This was based on conversations he had had with her, but nothing was in writing, unfortunately. In February 2000, the courts ruled that there was clear and convincing evidence, and this is a legal standard that perhaps Laurie can talk about later on, that Terry would not want to live the way she was. Her feeding tube was first removed in April 2001 and then again in October 2003. Each time the courts ordered the tube to be replaced and put back in because of lawsuits brought by Terry's parents. That brings us to the current situation in which the tube was ordered removed again. This was done about 2 weeks ago on March 18th. With appeals by Terry's parents, this time rejected by higher courts. Now, Dr. Benedict, what exactly is meant by capacity determination, and how has it impacted Terry Schiavo?
Well, capacity determination is a loaded question. The first thing I always ask when somebody inquires about capacity is capacity for what? You can have capacity, for instance, to live independently, capacity to make decisions about something. The latter is probably most germane to the Schiavo case.
And you know, it's very interesting that you mention that, because in a nursing home setting, I've had the situation where someone's clearly able to say who they would want to make decisions for them, but they can in no way explain or understand specific health care issues like having a feeding tube placed or being put on a ventilator. So it's that kind of thing that you're talking about. There's different levels of capacity per se, and so go on.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Some other examples of the kinds of capacity questions that we're asked to address are capacity to refuse treatment, for instance. Capacity to refuse a particular medication, capacity to designate someone as a power of attorney, capacity to decide whether or not they should donate $100,000 to the Greenhouse Fund.
Capacity, whether they want to go back to the hospital for care or stay where they are at home or in a facility, whatever facility they happen to be living in.
Exactly. And so each of those questions should be addressed independently when you're doing an assessment of someone.
Now let's get to legal.
Well, I have a question for the doctor, actually. When you were just speaking, you said that she was determined never to be able to regain consciousness again. That's my clinical question, is what is consciousness? I mean, you know, it seems like if you have functioning somewhere, you may be cognizant of your surroundings, not simply able to communicate back. It's a slippery slope, I would say, when we're starting to judge, you know, what level of consciousness somebody has by just looking at them, or is there a physiological determination here that you're talking about? I kind of wanted to know what that word meant, and then we'll go back into capacity, because there are different legal capacities too.
Yeah, I summarized the case and used the word consciousness, but the doctors went further to say that she was really not cognizant of her surroundings, could not respond to external stimulus, and effectively was in a persistent vegetative state.
What is consciousness?
Now we have to bring the philosophers in, I think.
There are lots of definitions of consciousness. The psychological definition is to be able to employ decision-making and respond to the environment in a reliable manner and to have some recollection of that.
Okay.
Clearly, Ms. Schiavo was nowhere close to anything like that. Now, I have seen cases in the hospital setting where we're dealing with a patient that has possible conscious processing, but is nevertheless quadriplegic or almost cannot interact with the environment very well. If you'd like, I could tell you about such.
Yeah, there are things called locked-in syndrome where someone can't move, they can't express anything, but nevertheless, if you spoke to them, they can actually take in what you're saying, but there's no way they can respond to that. So that's one example of someone who appears unconscious and without any ability to think, but they actually can. But that's not the case here in Terry Schiavo's case, as determined by several doctors over many years. So with regard to capacity, then, how do we sort out the different levels or different aspects, or is it irrelevant? Do we just need to define what we're looking at, what we need someone to have capacity for, and then specifically test them to see whether they're able to make that decision?
I think between the legal and medical fields, I have actually participated in several joint sessions where we try to hash this out, because it can be a difference between what the doctor determines to be a capacity, a state of capacity. For example, if I go into a facility where you may be the physician, and if you haven't made a determination as to the capacity of someone there, it's up to me, according to the court, as an officer of the court, that I can actually determine by asking certain questions whether I would believe and notarize something as a signature of somebody that they have the legal capacity, as far as I understand it and as far as it's defined for me, to have them sign a document. And sometimes that's a slippery place for me to be in, because without having this document that should have been, they should have come to my office a year ago and had it signed when they were all healthy. Instead, I'm called in because Dad's dementia has now slipped again. He's now hospitalized, and we do not have authority to work with any of his assets, for example. So I come in and I see that he definitely is, you know, his family's very close to him. They're the only ones that are going to be doing this on his behalf. However, I need to determine whether or not he understands what he's doing. And there's a different capacity level for a power of attorney as compared to drafting a will, as compared to, you know, and so for me to make that determination scares me sometimes, because I'd like to make sure that I've talked to the doctor and find out what his assessment is of the patient before I just come in, see him one day. He could be having a good day or a bad day, or actually have kind of an automatic response to people that come and visit him, or some type of placating response, that a lot of people actually are really good at looking like they've got it all together when actually their capacity may be in a questionable place.
Well, that's interesting, and something I wasn't aware of. And I think you're saying that there actually is a legal ability for an attorney to make a capacity decision?
Well, it's kind of left to me, because I have to notarize the document.
And it would be unethical if you notarized a document and the person really didn't understand what you were saying.
Exactly.
Clearly.
For example, for a will, the capacity level would be that they need to understand the objects of their bounty and the extent and specifics of, not necessarily specifics, but what they do own. You know, what is the extent of their bounty? So that they need to know, you know, approximately that they've got a bank account here and an annuity, and this is what they want to divide up, and who do they love, or what is their interest in giving it to? So, you do have to sort of know a few things before I can have you sign your will.
Now, do the courts allow you to make that determination on your own, or are you...
Well, there will be another witness, and we also have, you know, will formalities in New York State that require us both to sign an affidavit saying that we've spoken to this person, that they are of sound mind. And, you know, a lot of people are leery to be a witness if they're questioning the capacity of the person, because it can come back and bite you. I mean, no one wants to end up in court.
So you don't have to be a clinician to make this determination. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I didn't know that.
So, you know, if it does come back and someone contests it, that's when probably someone like Dr. Benedict would get involved in doing formal assessments as to the capacity. But then
it's
you're
later.
Also talking, it's usually later, years later often, and how do you go back to find out what the person's capacity was several years before? Very difficult.
That's why things end up in court, really. And on a practical matter, how can you actually ask a doctor to verify everyone's capacity? I mean, seriously, some of my clients don't seem capacitated and they're just quite fine. So, you know, for us to have, just because someone's older, we shouldn't have to have a capacity determination in every time that I'm signing a will or a power of attorney. Hmm. And a lot of people, you know, don't realize that they may even be going in and out of, like, you know, remembering everything. They're losing it a little. I mean, it's a sliding scale that we go down. I don't think it's always an accident or a brain hemorrhage that causes the capacity problem.
Well, you know, as I've talked about and my guests on previous shows have spoken about, there's a lot of issues involved in an older person's health that can simulate thinking problems, cause thinking problems that are potentially correctable. So you can have a waxing and waning capacity of a person. So I think what we're talking about is a team approach, and maybe you know, the lawyers need to utilize someone like Dr. Benedict more often. Maybe Dr. Benedict needs to reach out more to people that really aren't as skilled as a clinician in making capacity determination to offer his services, or at least help develop the guidelines as to how a non-clinician should go about making a capacity decision. Mm-hmm. Let me get into the whole issue of advanced directives now. Okay, we talked a little bit about capacity determination, and the key issue there is, is a person able to understand and think about and respond appropriately to a specific question, whatever that question might be, and that there's different levels, like assigning whether they would want their daughter to make decisions for them if they're not able to, or whether they would not want to go to the hospital under any circumstances. Do they really understand that? They might understand one and not the other. Now, we have documents called advanced directives. And really, we're not quite at the document level yet. An advanced directive first starts out in someone's mind and feelings and desires as to what they want for themselves for the future. And we're talking specifically about healthcare matters, advanced directives for healthcare matters. So, Lori, why don't you talk a little bit about advanced directives? What is an advanced directive? And what different forms can an advance directive take?
Let me go ahead and tell you how excited I am that we're having this conversation today, and that I think everyone who services the elderly in this community needs to have continued and more aggressive discussions so that we actually formulate a presence, that we're here and we know each other, and that we're there as a reliable resource for people who are actually negotiating this path of aging here in Western New York. And that's why we got in touch with Dr. Stahl, and I think that all of us have the same kind of issues we're looking at it from a different light, and as a team we can actually help our clients and our patients in a much better way. So I'm grateful for you having me here today. And the advanced directives that we're talking about specifically in Terry's case would be a healthcare proxy or a living will. And these are just one of several documents by which an advanced directive means that you decide in advance of an incapacity what you would like to have happen if, in fact, you were to lose the ability to explain it at a future date. And so the neat thing about planning, and about if there's anything good that comes out of this whole nightmare down in Florida, would be that more of us are talking about the fact that we don't always have these difficult conversations with our family. And that even, and especially, when money gets involved, I think, you know, part of this timeline may have involved when a personal injury settlement came in, and, you know, there's a lot of stuff that we don't know about what went on in Florida, and the fact that each of these appeals costs a lot of money, and that most people don't have the money to take this type of case as far as this one has gone. That most of these things are taken care of, hopefully, by family members that can look at the best interest of the person that's actually lacking capacity, rather than what they're trying to make up for. That some, I mean, a lot of dysfunctional family relations find their way into courtrooms. They find their way into different people wanting different things for a person who they love, but they may have not. It, for example, you have a daughter who lives in California and one here who's been taking care of dad for the last 5 years, and the daughter here is the health care proxy, hopefully, but if they haven't written one, then dad goes into the hospital, the daughter from California comes back and is saying, dad can be saved. Basically, translate that to, I can't let go of dad, I have a lot of guilt feelings, I still need to hold on to him, I'm now acting out on these other issues that are my own, or whatever it is, but that the sister who's here says, you haven't seen dad going down and down and down, and it's time to let him mercifully pass. And therefore, you know, if you don't have anything written, and there's no wife, and there's, you know, two equal siblings pulling at, you know, the same issue, these things need to be talked about within families. And to tell you the truth, a lot of families might never be able to have this conversation because of the way they're organized or the way they get along or don't get along. And so the best thing for healthy, you know, relatively acclimated families to do is to have these discussions and then put them down in writing so that we don't have these problems.
One of the most important things to remember is that a healthcare proxy is a document where you designate who you would want to make decisions for yourself if you're no longer able to make decisions for yourself. And that healthcare proxy, who is then called the healthcare agent, is supposed to act as you would have acted, what you want, and in a way that relieves a large burden on a healthcare agent in that they don't have to think about what they would want at their point in life. Generally, they're a lot younger, 30 years, 40 years younger. They're not even thinking about death and the ultimate at that point. And it's hard to know when you're 40, 50, 60 years old what you would want when you're 80 years old. But if the 80-year-old parent writes down and says, I don't want to be put on a breathing machine under any circumstances. I want nature to take its course. When it's my time to go, it's my time to go. Then that healthcare agent merely has to reflect those prior stated wishes. And that's why having a healthcare proxy and also talking with that healthcare agent about what you would want under those circumstances is so important. And on a healthcare proxy form, you can also write in specifically what you would want. So it's very clear. You don't have to leave it up to someone having to remember a conversation that you had with them in the past.
Right. And that's a statutory document in New York State, meaning that it's honored by all of the courts. And so that would be the place that you would want to put those instructions. Although a living will, which is something else that everyone's been talking about, so I should clarify how that works in New York State, is simply a statement of your wishes, and it does provide clear and convincing evidence to the court what you would have wanted in the event that there's an argument over the decisions that are made by your proxy. So that your proxy does, I mean, it's the one legal document that you would really want in New York State as a healthcare proxy. It's just the living will is an evidence of your thoughts and writing about your end-of-life treatment.
Why don't we just pause right there, take a breather. This is pretty heavy stuff, very important material to talk about and discuss and also to take home with us and do something about. So we'll listen to our break song, and we'll be back in a few minutes.
For I might just have wanted you. I'm While everyone needs legal advice and guidance at various times in their life, the legal needs of the elderly can often hold very serious consequences for them and their family. I'm Lori Menzies, a senior partner with Balzgraf, Feinauer, and Menzies. We are Western New York's only law firm organized to service the needs of the elderly and their families. From estate management to long-term care planning, we can make sure that all of your loved ones are protected and financially prepared for whatever the coming years may bring. We also offer the additional service of a certified geriatric care manager on staff. We'll treat you with the respect and kindness you deserve while helping you navigate smoothly through the complicated legal paths that today's seniors face.
When your family isn't sure who to turn to, call on Western New York's only law firm that concentrates on the needs of the elderly and their families. Balzgraf, Feinauer, and Menzies. Call them today at 204-1055. That's 204-1055, or learn more online at pbmlawyers.com.
Balzgraf, Feinauer, and Menzies. Counsel for generations.
Okay, we're back now, and I think you recognize the voice on that brief ad, and that was Lori Menzies, and we have her here in the studio today, as well as Dr. Ralph Benedict, a neuropsychologist at ECMC, Erie County Medical Center. I want to give a few numbers before we go on. To reach Ms. Menzies, her office is 204-1055, like you just heard in the ad. And Dr. Benedict can be reached at his ECMC office, 898-4905. We're talking about advanced directives and capacity determination with my guests. And you can call in with your questions, 855-6848. I want to continue our discussion on specific advanced directives and also go through how exactly can we determine capacity. What kind of questions need to be asked? And I'm going to go through a hypothetical case right now that might help illustrate these concepts along with the Scheibel case that we've been talking about. And the scenario I'm about to read is slightly modified from a presentation Dr. Benedict gives when teaching health professionals. And here it is. An 83-year-old woman denies having any health problems. Her memory has gotten worse, and she has had periods of confusion. Her family was told 6 months ago that she had Alzheimer's disease. She says, however, she manages her own finances, can cook for herself, takes medicine as prescribed without assistance, and wants to stay living alone in her own house. One son claims that she is disabled and requires a guardian, but the other son feels that she's doing just fine and should be left alone. Dr. Benedict, a common scenario, I'm sure, and where do you start with this?
Well, the first question is, what's my role here? In a case like this, I need to do a couple of different things. One is, first of all, do a clinical assessment of the patient to get a sense of what her cognitive function is like. In this particular case, we determined, for instance, that she had very severe memory impairment, as well as other cognitive deficits in the areas of higher executive function, for instance, and language.
Okay, now let's just stop there. Cognition is what, and let's go through the areas of cognition spelled out, and that would provide a framework for how you do your assessment. So cognition is?
Cognition is thinking capacity. What your brain can do other than move.
Okay, and the main areas of thinking are memory and?
Attention or concentration, language, the use of words, spatial abilities, and what we call higher executive functions, like the ability to reason, form novel concepts, solve problems.
Understand a joke, perhaps?
Understand a joke, right? Yes. Form conceptual similarities with two different things they haven't seen before. And then the tests that we use can quantify these abilities, and you can think of scores as being put on a scale of percentile ranks or standard scores like an IQ test. One could have an IQ for language, one could have a memory IQ, for instance.
When they start to decline, do they decline at the same ratio, or could you have a high-functioning language IQ and be spatially, you know, at a deficit?
Absolutely. It depends on the disease.
And what part of the brain it affects, perhaps?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
And so my job is to look at these kinds of data and consider what we know about the integrity of the brain through structural MRI and the history that the patient's presenting, and determine why there is cognitive impairment, what the prognosis is, and what might be done about it. In this particular case you're referring to, we found that there were very severe impairments in memory and language, but the course of the illness wasn't strongly suggestive of Alzheimer's disease. There were periods where she was relatively high functioning and then had an abrupt onset of cognitive impairment. So it suggested that perhaps there was a cerebrovascular component to her illness as well as slowly progressing Alzheimer's.
So like having many strokes along the way that gradually chipped away at her cognitive function.
Precisely.
Okay. And that's a fairly common type of dementia. And dementia, let's clarify, Alzheimer's and dementia.
Dementia is a clinical state. It just means that there are cognitive impairments in more than one area.
Okay, so dementia is problems with thinking ability, basically.
It's enough to affect what we can do in day-to-day life.
Okay, and Alzheimer's disease is one type of dementia.
It's a disease that causes dementia.
Okay.
And there are hundreds of diseases.
Because there's often confusion about that. People are told that their loved one has dementia, and then another time they're told they have Alzheimer's. Which one do they have? So, okay. Now, let's get to the main issue here. This woman's living at home. One son feels that she needs a guardian. The other son doesn't feel she needs anything. Now, what's the important thing for this woman? We want to help this woman and make sure that her life, one, is as functional as possible, two, enjoyable as possible, and also in this kind of situation is safe. Safety is a major factor in this kind of scenario. So how do you go about assessing that?
Well, the safety issue and thinking about is she capable of living independently is largely determined by a physician's appraisal of her physical abilities and my appraisal of her mental abilities. And in this particular case, for instance, she claimed to be driving her car with some frequency, and it was clear from my assessment of her that she was not capable of doing that in a safe manner. It was clear that she was not capable of remembering well enough to perform common activities of daily living like financial and medical management.
Well, let's go back to the car. What exactly were the dangerous things about her driving?
She claimed to be driving on a regular basis when, in fact, I determined through history taking with collateral sources of information that she wasn't driving at all.
So okay.
She was simply making that up. I would have been surprised to find that she was driving based on how cognitively impaired she was anyway.
So what?
I had my doubts about that just based on my assessment.
If she was in the car, what problems would she have had? Probably getting lost might have been a problem.
Getting lost, forgetting where she is and where she's going. And also something that's not often appreciated is when someone is driving, they are constantly engaging in what we might call divided attention. You're thinking about two or three things at one time. You're trying to remember where you're going while you're reacting to stimuli in your environment. If the driving situation becomes novel, the person's confronted with something they haven't had to deal with before, then the capacity for that is exponentially increased. And if someone has a deficit in the ability to do that, to engage in dual tasking, then they may break down at that point and not react very well.
Well, in June, I'm planning a show dedicated to older driving, and should you be on the road, I might have you back for that. I didn't think of this twist exactly.
The motor skills, too, would be something that could be effective.
Yeah, well, it would be a pleasure to talk more about that.
Actually, Dr. Stoff, if I could jump in.
Sure, absolutely.
I think part of what we would be looking at would be an overall assessment by someone like a geriatric care manager who would then be able to bring in the neurological end, the physical end, that the doctor would be able to see what their capacities were, and then look at what all of the different available resources are in the community, and including like a driving assessment that we do have here in Erie County that takes the burden off of the son's arguing whether she can or can't and who's got the keys, that you actually, and no one has to be the guilty party that actually there would be an assessment done.
Well, that's determination. That's exactly an approach I have in the office when clearly family does not want my patient to be on the road, and from what they describe, it doesn't sound like it would be a good idea, but taking away the keys is often a death knell for certain people. Me, yeah. Personally, I'd be happy if someone took away the keys and chauffeured me around for the rest of my life. That would be fine with me. Mm-hmm. But one way to get around it is what I do, and what you just said is to say, look, I have concerns about your driving. If you pass with flying colors, if you pass a formal driving test, then I have no problem letting you go back on the road. If it shows that you have some problems, then maybe some training, extra training, is going to help. If it says that you know, you shouldn't be on the road, period, then I'm going to have to abide by that.
Dr. Stahl, at this, like, our hopefully our audience is listening, and I always try to picture myself when I'm 41 now, but it seemed to have gone really fast, and before I know it, I'm going to be my dad's 88.
42.
Yeah, well, my dad's. They just got a brand new car, but I think that I've taken some courses in my senior, to be a senior advisor, and part of what happens to our lifestyle is every time another piece of our connection to society is taken away, it's a big blow to our life, and I don't know. I mean, I can't go without my Wegmans fix every day. I need to pick out my own grapes, and I don't necessarily trust that anyone will get me the right ones, sure. And I don't want that taken away from me. I got a big kind of scary feeling when I heard you talking that it's okay for us to kind of throw this around, but when it's happening to you, I think this is a significant change in someone's life, and what they feel is their ability to lead a whole life. That's one more thing that happens. You lose your ability to sort of self-direct.
Right.
I mean, having a chauffeur is great, but you may not have a chauffeur. No one may be
no,
there to
absolutely.
Take you,
and,
you know?
You know, certainly any kind of loss, and the loss of a car in our society is a major loss of freedom.
Absolutely.
And I certainly have patients that don't want to burden a friend, even though friends are more than willing to take them around. They just don't want to put that upon
but
them.
But then that's when things like geriatric care manager, and I'm saying this because I find it to be such an unused resource, and that somebody that knows all the different resources in Western New York would say, okay, now maybe you'd be willing to go somewhere like an assisted living facility where you have your own place, but that there's vans that go everywhere. You can come to see other people and not be so isolated, because once you, you know, once you may have lost your spouse, you're in a big home that was at one point in your life the appropriate place to live, because that was where the whole family was. But now you've got single people alone in a big home and very isolated once the car's gone. But there are other ways to, like, sort of take your life into a new and exciting phase. It doesn't have to be worse. It's just that it's changing.
Yeah, and, you know, there are geriatric care managers out there, and I think what you've done with your law practice by having a full-time geriatric care manager work with you in helping to coordinate beyond the financial needs and the trusts and what to do with that, to coordinate care, to go that step beyond just what a lawyer does, I think is key. And that's you know, building the teamwork, the team that's going to do the best for that person. And you know, if people, I doubt many people are aware of Dr. Benedict and neuropsychology, and how a neuropsychologist can help clarify all this. And I admit myself that perhaps I haven't utilized his services as much as I should. In nursing homes, where I do much of my work, this issue comes up time and again. The Schiavo case is not unique by any means in this country. It just happened to get all the publicity it got because the people had the money to move it from one court to another, and politicians got involved as well. But this same scenario might not be a person quite as young as Terry Schiavo, which adds to a certain degree the interest in the case, but it does play out in people her age and even more often in older people that have no advance directives. And the law in New York State says that you have to provide nutrition and hydration if there are no advance directives in place. You could take that to court, and then the court can look at evidence of conversations the person may have had with friends and family, that the person was visiting another relative and they thought it was terrible how they were just being maintained on a tube or were on a ventilator and couldn't function at all. And they said, I would never want to be like that. So, but never wrote it down. This is just in a conversation. And that kind of evidence can be put before the court and valued. And this is actually what happened in the Schiavo case, that Michael Schiavo, the husband, had discussions like this with his wife. And that's exactly why the courts ruled that the tube should be taken out, because she would not have wanted to live in the condition she's been living.
I'll play devil's advocate for a second, though, because for the first 7 years that she was living that way, that he didn't bring that up. It wasn't taken to court until 7 years after they were trying to keep her alive to say that she didn't want to be kept alive. So I have a little bit of a problem with the length of time that it took for someone to say what really was a conversation that must have been 7 years prior before she actually lost capacity, because she has been without capacity for 7 years before anyone said this is what she wanted. So
yeah, I mean, there's the nuances.
And I'm on
of,
both sides of this, so I'm not, you know.
I mean, it's very hard to know without being there, without knowing all the detail, without hearing Terry say that to Michael. You really don't know what was said. But also, you know, brain injuries, you generally do want to give it a couple of years to see if the brain is able to respond in some way. Mm-hmm. I've had people improve remarkably a year after they've had a stroke. So, you know, 7 years is a little ways out, certainly, but, you know, there is the possibility that was, that's when they gave up.
Right. I think what we were talking about during the break, Dr. Stahl, was quite interesting, and that was about someone having made determinations and in advance directives that they actually then decided when the time came and they were sitting in front of the doctor that they didn't want. They changed their mind. Do you remember what we were talking about?
Yeah, and you know, I think that comes down to does the person have capacity at that point to change their mind? That's the main issue there. And that's where Dr. Benedict and the physicians come in again.
That I deal with that with some frequency at ECMC. Is this patient making a lucid decision about wanting to withdraw somebody as their healthcare proxy or their power of attorney? I want to point somebody else. I think I don't need a healthcare proxy now, and I can make this decision on my own. And there's a common strategy we use with all of those cases. What we do first is determine what the objective information is about the particular condition, and then I go to the bedside and I ask the patient spontaneously for their description of this problem. Sometimes patients have memory disorders but are able to make a lucid and reliable decision, and sometimes information hasn't been adequately explained to them by the other doctors. And so I will then provide that information. I'll get that from the chart or talking to the attending physician. And then I will ask them again about the decision or the opinion that they have. And sometimes that opinion will change with the new information that's been applied. And then what's also very important is that I'm not done yet, because I need to go back at a later time to see if this decision is reliable. That's very important. Sometimes people can be coerced into saying things, even subtly, because they're comfortable with the person questioning them, and so forth. And so it's also good to even have a different person go back and ask them the same question.
As a non-clinician, generally I tell my clients that on a normal case, if they change their mind or whatever they tell the doctor up until they can no longer speak is what the doctor will be doing. If they go into an emergency room and say, wait, change my mind, hook me up, the doctor will do that as long as you have capacity. And then afterward, the documents have. And then to go along with what you were just saying, I think that as a lay person, my ears do perk up when people do start to change their mind frequently about who they want as, for example, their executor, or I don't want my power of attorney any longer, I don't trust them, and then they're changing their mind back and forth and back and forth. So then you start to, you know, even as a silly old attorney, wonder what their capacity may be or whether we should have that checked out.
Well, there's something called activation of the healthcare proxy, and that's when the person is determined not to have capacity to make healthcare decisions. And what doctors, other healthcare people sometimes fall into is bypassing the patient and going right to the healthcare proxy when the patient actually has not been determined to lack capacity and can still make decisions for themselves. It might be easier to go to the son or daughter whose name because they speak faster or they're more direct, and it's just more effort to get the answers out of the patient themselves. But it's really not proper.
I think that's one of the most important things for all of us who work with people who are in the aging population, is that we remember who our clients are, and that when somebody calls my office and says, my mom needs a power of attorney, I need to know who's bringing mom in and whether mom is actually under her own volition asking for these things to be done, and that she does understand what's going on, and that she is my client, not the daughter who wants things to be done.
Well, it's excellent that you recognize that, because I'm sure, many attorneys would just say, fine, let's come in and let's do it. And while we're on power of attorney, there's really a difference between power of attorney and the power of attorney for healthcare matters. And maybe, Laura, you can just describe the difference.
Well, actually, they become, the power of attorney for financial matters is the New York State statutory form. There are two different ones. One is a springing power of attorney that actually has to involve a capacity question, and another one is a durable general power of attorney. And to avoid having to deal with doctors regularly, I usually encourage a general durable power of attorney.
Now, what's the matter with doctors?
But actually, it's only because I think the more professionals you get involved in any situation, the more confusing we make it, and besides that, it's generally more costly. So, But basically, really, the difference would be that durable general power of attorney begins to take effect the moment you sign it, and it's notarized, and it's durable through your incapacity. It's valid today, and you put it with your important documents. And then when you need to use it, somebody can, and there's a caution on there, because it's actually quite powerful. You can use that document as if you were that person. The requirement is, though, that you act in their best interest and that you're doing what you would know they would want to have you do. So then you've got to get into the fact that we have to go through your financial discussions and put together a plan for you, so that you're not just giving someone power to do what they think is best for you. When you've got five children and only one is selected as your power of attorney, because you do have to, you can select more than one, but you don't want to hear the nightmare scenarios when you have three sisters who can't get along all on simultaneous power of attorney duty, and that the power of attorney says that they must agree before anything can get done. We're stuck in the water. The other power of attorney quickly is called a springing power of attorney, and those are not effective when they're signed, but become effective when two physicians actually declare your incompetence. So those aren't turned on until you're actually incapacitated, which is sometimes a tricky thing and more difficult to actually get authorized. Sure. For someone to use.
Now, we're coming up to the hour, so I want to wrap up. One, I want to make sure everyone knows that if you need a healthcare proxy form, please call the station, and I'll be happy to send that out to you. Call the station, 855-6848. Leave a message for me, Dr. Robert Stahl, STALL, with your name, address, is all that's needed, and that you want a healthcare proxy form. This will be the official New York State healthcare proxy form, or another format that's equally valid in New York State, and we'll get it out to you. Number two, let's summarize the issue of healthcare proxies and why it's so important. And we've gone through a couple of cases that demonstrate why it's so important for you to express what you want if you're no longer able to make decisions for yourself. You can either leave it up to the courts, leave it up to your children who might have to fight over what you would have wanted, or you can state clearly right now what you want when and if that time comes. And certainly I think the last option is the better one. For you to talk about it might be uncomfortable to talk about. It's never comfortable to talk about when you're not able to think for yourself. But it's important to do. And for children of older parents, older friends, it's important to bring it up. And the older people are thinking about it. And often they're just waiting for someone to talk to them about it so that they can express what they want to do. Any final thoughts, Ralph or Laurie? I think this has been a great session. Certainly, this could have easily been a whole afternoon seminar or a day-long conference. I'll put links to important information on the website, whatshouldyouexpect.com. I'll put information on how you can reach Dr. Benedict and Laurie at her law firm to follow up. And please call if you have questions. And please take the step to put in place what you want to be done if you're not able to decide for yourself. I want to thank again Laurie's law firm, Falsgraf, Beinauer, and Menzies for sponsoring the show. Laurie can be reached at 204-1055, Dr. Benedict at 898-4905. I'd like to thank my daughter, Lauren, 11 years old, who was very patient sitting here through a very complicated, difficult topic, especially for an 11-year-old, but she did so wonderfully. Next month, I'll have with me Ms. Susan Grelick and Dennis Gabershack, supervisors of the towns of Amherst and Cheektowaga, respectively, to talk about how to create a senior-friendly community. Should be interesting. This is Dr. Rob Stahl. See you then.
I get older, losing my head, many years from now. Will you still be sending me a Valentine? Birthday greetings, bottle of wine. If I'd been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?